Good evening and welcome to the New York Public Library. My name is Paul Holdengraber and I'm the Director of Public Programs here. As all of you know, I've said this many times, my goal here at the library is simply to make the lions roar, to oxygenate this heavy institution, to give some sound effect to those two lions, patience and fortitude. Tonight, a very surprising event, perhaps, at the library, Edible Estates. It appealed to me immediately upon meeting Fritz Haig, especially when he told me that the real purpose was to speak to me after this event about creating an edible estate in front of the library. Do you remember that, Fritz? So I think that would be perfect because many of you perhaps know that Paul Leclerc, the president of our library, is a Voltaire scholar, and particularly a Candide scholar. So for those of you who remember those memorable lines from Voltaire, we must cultivate our garden, and we do have Bryant Park right next door, and I'd like to make an appeal to Bryant Park, since it's contiguous with our organization here, to cultivate a garden that we will share with the Bryant Park, the New York Public Library Bryant Park garden made of vegetables such as those you have on your seat. The vegetables on your seat have a very important function. If any of the speakers speak too long, and I'm sure knowing the characters on stage, you would imagine that none will. But in any event, I felt this was the right moment to talk about an edible estate that matters to me greatly, which is an edible estate that my father created upon leaving Vienna. My parents, mother and father, left on separate boats in 1939, early 1939, from Vienna, and ended up spending the war years in Haiti. It was a very small Jewish community in Haiti of 109 families. My father was a medical doctor, often tells me there were two great medical schools, Paulie. One was in Vienna and the other one was in Montpellier. Even at age 89, he still talks about the two universities. He ended up being in Haiti as a doctor and he went to the library in Port-au-Prince after speaking to the Minister of Culture there, of Agriculture, excuse me, after speaking to the Minister of Agriculture, who told him he couldn't grow these kinds of vegetables, he thought he could. He went to the library and discovered in the library of Port-au-Prince that the soil was very similar to the soil that existed in Senegal. So he wrote as a friendly enemy alien, this is how he was called, as a friendly enemy alien, he wrote to Burpees. And Burpees send him thousands of grains, tens of thousands of grains, saying, "Dear Kurt Holdengraber, as a friendly enemy alien, we're sending you these grains. Try growing some vegetables." And about 10 years ago, when we went, my sister, my mother, and my father to Haiti, back for them, my father showed me on some farm stands some vegetables, some of them are on your chair, and said, "You see..." As he was showing me the farm stand, he showed me some vegetables he was the first to grow. And he said, "You see, here is my legacy." And of course, I turned to him very moved and I said, "We have to write this." And he said, "No, no, no. I sent you to very fine schools. You write it. I live it." And so we have a fabulous anthology of speaker's talent tonight. And anthology, of course, makes you immediately think of the etymology of the word, which is a gathering of flowers, a fabulous anthology of marvelous, marvelous speakers. Peter Sellers, very dear to my heart when I started organizing these kinds of events and creating havoc in Los Angeles, flew all the way from Adelaide to Los Angeles to hold a conversation with Esa-Pekka Salonen, the music director in Los Angeles on Stravinsky. He came for 17 hours, and he's probably traveled as far now to come here for a few hours. So I'm extremely happy to have him, to have all the other speakers, Fritz Haig, who is responsible for the edible estate and soon will be responsible for the edible estate in front of the New York Public Library. The various guests here have various books. They will sign those various books, their own, after the event. They will be sold on at that table there. 192 Books is our wonderful and, of course, independent bookstore. Metro is our sponsor for all matters print, such as getting the word out every day in the subway. You can find out what we're doing. And I highly recommend that you all join our email list so that you might find out some of the events we're doing in no particular order. Slavoj Žižek will be speaking about Hollywood on next Tuesday. We will have a big event on James Baldwin with Colm Tóibín, John Edgar Wideman, and many others. Nicholson Baker with Simon Winchester. A big event on Guantanamo with Wally Shawn and others. Pico Iyer and I will be in conversation. We have an event with Lee Siegel on his new book called Against the Machine, Being Human in the Age of the Electronic Mob, highly upbeat. Then Okwi Enwizor will be here to talk about his new exhibition about the archive with Boltanski, Luc Sant, Lorna Simpson, George Lewis. We will be celebrating the Penn World Voices Festival with a number of different events, Michael Ondaatje, Colin McCann. We will have Annie Prue here, Peter Esterhazy, Wayne Kirstenbaum. Then later in the year, Philip Gurevich and Errol Morris. In all likelihood, I will be interviewing Diane Keaton, Salman Rushdie. And finally, the event I'm most proud of, because it's the last, and a celebration of 100 years of Ian Fleming. We will be celebrating the birthday of Ian Fleming, and it will be an evening, of course, devoted to Bond. I mean, James Bond. So, without further ado, Fritz Haig and his crew. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul. I wanted to start out by framing this project specifically between two elections, really. The Edible Estates Project started immediately after the 2004 presidential election, and obviously we're on the eve of another one. And the project, Edible Estates, grew out of a real political moment that we had after that election, where supposedly our country divided in half between red and blue. And it was at that time that I had left the country for about 6 weeks to be in Australia at the Botanic Gardens there in Sydney and up in the Daintree rainforest. And I had this time to think about what I should be doing with my work. And after that election, I couldn't think of anything else. And beyond just thinking about left and right, red and blue, I was also just thinking in general about division and about how isolated I felt in my role as an architect and an artist in my society, and wanting to do a project that spoke to the whole of our country and all of our experiences and not just a small select few or the most, even necessarily the most open people. So the project started with a thought that had nothing to do with vegetables or food or lawns or gardens at all, even though those had been things that had been on my mind for a long time. The project started out with this impulse to do something in my work for my aunt who lives in Minneapolis, or for a family living in Kansas, or for people that lived outside of the world of contemporary art and architecture. So anyway, I came back from this trip, and the only thought I had was, okay, symbolically, I guess I need to do something in the geographic center of the country. That's all I can think of. When I got there, this isn't Kansas, by the way, but when I got to Kansas, I thought of the front lawn right away. It's a space that I grew up with. And it's a space that represents, not only does it represent so much wasted potential, but I think it's one of the rare things that we share in our society. And I think with the red-blue thoughts, I'm also thinking spatially in our city of what are the spaces that we share that cut across geographic, economic, social, all social boundaries. And this front lawn is something that we cultivate together. And I think also the other thing about the project that I was interested in is how can I make a project that can incite or welcome or inspire people to reassert their opinions and their ideas about the world that we should be living in. Anyway, before any thoughts of lawns and gardens, that's where my head is. Anyway, so I just wanted to start off this conversation that we'll be having with a few images to get us thinking of this, and then during the talk, these images will be going forward. So this basic premise of taking a space that was previously isolating families from the streets that they lived on and wasting precious resources like water and polluting our air and polluting our water as chemicals are dumped into it, planting that space with a garden that will feed the family that lives there. It's a very simple premise of focused very specifically on the front lawn, that moment where the public on the street meets the private realm of the house. So far, four gardens have been planted in London, New Jersey, California, and Kansas. And next weekend, I'll be going to Texas, where we'll be planting the fifth edition in front of a large apartment complex. And again, I'm looking for moments where people are living, where large, vast lawns are isolating people from where they live, from the communities that they're a part of. So we'll be planting this next weekend, and then just last weekend I was in Baltimore, and I selected this family after receiving maybe 30 emails from people in Baltimore. So we'll be planting their garden number 6 in April. So my goal is to do 9 gardens, and I really only have time to do a couple a year, so maybe in a few years I'll finish that series. So the book is something that I've been working on for a year now, I suppose. And it's just so funny to me that this project started with a little group show about food in Salina, Kansas for the Salina Art Center. And now I'm in the New York Public Library talking about my book about it. It's kind of amazing. But I think the thing I've found most inspiring about the project are these individual relationships I've developed with these families across the country that I otherwise never would have met. The project is so personal, and it's so tactile and visceral, getting your hands in your dirt, in the dirt, planting food with other people. And as this idea of the ephemeral garden that changes over time, I'm constantly feeling the need to record it and tell this story somehow. So there's the garden that's always changing that very few people actually see. And then there's the stories that are handed down that turn it into hopefully some sort of movement through videos and through this book. And the book, I think, of not just a chronicle of the gardens, but as something that goes out into the world to tell the story of these rarely seen gardens that can be held up as models or examples. Anyway, so when we were talking about having this event for the book, my first thought was having some sort of the worst thing is to have a panel of people that all agree with each other, you know, where everyone just says yes, we hate lawns, growing food is great, let's do that, and then, you know, I don't know what you talk about from there. So then I thought, okay, well, let's have a real smackdown. Let's get the lawn industry here. Let's have some housing associations via satellite or something, and have it get really ugly, and let's have a debate. And then, you know, that's ridiculous too, because that's a very smug way of saying we're right and you're wrong, and it's all about this kind of good and evil thing that we're trying to get away from. Because the project isn't really about that. The project is about using these gardens as vehicles to examine the world that we're living in today. I don't view these gardens as... I use a lot of provocative propaganda, I suppose, in the language that I use, but I like to think of these gardens as poetic provocations on the street that somehow, once they happen, arouse thoughts and force us to examine the world that we're living in and our relationship to the systems that support us, like food, like our communities. And anyway, so that was idea number two, which wasn't so good. So then I think the thing that's been most interesting about the project as it's developed is that's been completely I was not particularly prepared for or aware of when I started it, was how much this little teeny vegetable garden project was at the convergence of so many big issues. The cities that we live in and how we arrange them and how we appropriate land, our relationship to our neighbors and our community and the people around us, our relationship to food and where it comes from, our use of increasingly precious resources. So the conversation we'll have tonight is between people who all represent the highest level of thought of these different topics. So we have Dolores Hayden, who's the professor of architecture, urbanism, and American studies at Yale University, and the author of A Field Guide to Sprawl, which I read about in the New York Times. There was a story by Patricia Leigh Brown that really charmed me a few years ago. Frederick Hoffman, who is the author of A Short History of the American Stomach, and the book is for sale here, and he can sign it for you after, and a professor at City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism. Shamim Momin, who's probably exhausted, I can't imagine, after planning the Whitney Biennial for the last year that just opened up to the public yesterday. And finally, Peter Sellers, who I'm just so honored has made it here. He invited me to his class at UCLA this year. He's the renowned theater director, but also he's a teacher, an amazing teacher, and he has this class of 450 students that he's been teaching for 20 years at UCLA about art and politics. And every semester it's a different topic. And I visited him this year when it was food, and he had Alice Waters and Michael Pollan and Eric Schlosser visiting these lucky undergrads that won't know for decades how totally lucky they were to have that class. A few of them did know how lucky they were, and they were very eager in the front row. So we're going to start out by telling stories. Each one of us is going to tell you a story. And then we're going to somehow have that weave into a conversation among us. So the story I would like to tell you is about the artist Merle Laderman Ukelis, who did this project in 1980 that was so thoroughly inspiring to me, that grew out of her real feminist art practice in what she called maintenance art. And the project that she did was called Touch Sanitation. She spent 11 months individually shaking the hand of every single New York sanitation worker and thanking them and saying to each one of them, thanks for keeping New York City alive. And the thing I love about this project and why I think it's related to the Edible Estates project is taking these systems in our cities that we depend upon and making them visible to us again. Because today we're living in cities where all of those things that make our lives so pleasant have been hidden from us, and we have no idea of the cost. I think generations ago you lived in a town and you knew exactly what the costs were because you saw them immediately in the landscape around you, where all your trash went, where all your resources were coming from. Today we're living in these ridiculous bubbles where we have no idea. And I know that each of us would probably make very different decisions today on a daily basis if we knew exactly the impact of each one of our decisions made, or maybe there's no option. There are no other options for the decisions that we're making, which is even worse. But I think there's something even more provocative and exciting about her project going to the most basic place of the thing we most want to hide from view. I think, sure, there's something kind of poetic and beautiful about growing food in our front yard, but what about the trash? And I think that's a much more interesting place to go and to think about. And she did a whole series of projects about sanitation in New York in particular. And this picture, there's something about this picture that I love. This project grew out of her becoming a mother and thinking about the work she was doing as a mother and thinking about that in the larger picture in society. And I think there's those tasks that we tend not to take very seriously, that we all depend upon. So that's my story. Fred.
It's time for my story. My story. Well, my story is a much older story. I like to go back a long way in my history of the American stomach and what it is we're doing with that stomach. First of all, I want to say, although Fritz, is welcoming all sorts of polemics about his ideas here, I want to say that I think this is a great idea. I just want to go on the record right now. This is a good thing, okay? I do have a couple of addenda I'd like to add, and I'd also like to put in a little bit of historical context, as I said. Now, first, of course, my first addenda is, I think, how about this, Fritz? How about smokable estates? Now, yeah, obviously. No, but seriously.
I'm feeling better.
You're feeling better.
It improves my night. Thank you.
We got to put this in some context. You know, this did not happen yesterday or last year. This country, America, has long made extravagant claims for the moral virtue of horticulture. It is nothing new. In the middle of the 19th century, tending your garden and horticulture was widely touted as a cure for alcoholism. Yeah, this is true. Let's go back for a moment to 1793, just a little bit more than 200 years ago, to the statement made by the Massachusetts Society for the Promotion of Agriculture. They were anticipating Fritz Haig tonight and this panel. They declared their goal to be nothing less than the benefit of the human species at large. That's right, the Massachusetts Society for Promoting Agriculture. And this is clearly they were anticipating what we're doing here tonight. The great Horace Mann, the great educator Horace Mann, he called horticultural refinement, and I'm reading because I want to get the quotes right, the emblem and augury of all refinement. Okay? On the other hand, those who lack interest in horticulture, those people who look at you funny when you're planting your front lawn with tomatoes and squash and zucchini, right? They have long represented a failure of public virtue in our culture. Deep failure if they don't get it. Edible estates is such a good idea that in the early 18-teens and 1820s, you had the beginnings of the New York Horticultural Society and the Massachusetts Horticultural Society and the Philadelphia Horticultural Society. And of course, the members of these societies, they were not farmers. Oh no. This is the cultural elite we're talking about. We're talking about the merchants and the bankers and the manufacturers and the old money and the new money and, of course, the intellectuals. Now, they were led. Their spiritual leader was this gentleman who we see up here. His name was Andrew Jackson Downing. Andrew Jackson, a man who's been somewhat lost to history because he died in a very young age in a very untimely manner. But he published a magazine called The Horticulturist, to which Frederick Law Olmsted used to write letters to the editor. And this magazine, like Fritz Haig's new publication, Edible Estates, published endless moral essays on horticulture. In fact, here's a quote from Mr. Downing. He who owns a rood of proper land in this country, now what's a rood? Right, a rood of land, right? This is roughly about a third of an acre, which is about precisely this area, this space of the front lawn. He who owns a rood of proper land and in the face of all the pomonal riches of the day. What's a pomonal rich? That's like fruits and vegetables, stuff like that. Only raises crabs and choke pears. And by this, Andrew Jackson Downing also meant to mean the grass of the front lawn. He meant to say front lawn too. Deserves to lose the respect of all sensible men. And not only was horticulture a means for us to be virtuous, but in fact he went farther than that. He described the problem. The typical American human being was a plant. This is all of us. We're Americans. We are unable to take root anywhere. This leads to the uncertain life of a tree transplanted from place to place and shifted to different soil every season. But despite all this, America was still a hope for Europe, because here we had fresh soil, whereas in Europe they had exhausted vegetable races. Now, with all this history of planting and virtue in mind, I would now like to add my true, bold new element to the future of this project. We have to remember that the Massachusetts Historical Society in 1831 inaugurated Mount Auburn. Has anybody ever been to Mount Auburn? The first and foremost rural cemetery in this country. That's right, here was also a means of getting virtue from the land. The society said, the man of business and care would often reassure his hesitating virtue. So I hereby propose that we take edible estates one step further. And for the sake of virtue and the moral integrity of this country, tomorrow we begin to plant our cemeteries.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Dolores?
Well, now we've got the horticultural context, and I'd like to say a little bit about America as a suburban nation. The United States, of course, has more residents living in suburbs than residents living in central cities and rural areas combined. And the Edible Estates Project challenges this landscape in a way which is new, and it is a way of pointing out that some of these landscapes are at the heart of American material culture. Now, I wrote a book called Building Suburbia that tracks the history of American suburbanization right from the time of Andrew Jackson Downing and Catherine Beecher, who were the author of self-help books that individual middle-class people carried out to the suburban areas where they hoped to buy a farm or maybe a couple of lots from a farmer and then set themselves up with suburban villas. That was the stage when the suburbs were really new, the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s. People were getting there maybe by steamboat, getting there on horseback, and then eventually perhaps on a railroad. Following that came an era when people were building picturesque enclaves and hiring architects and landscape architects to design them with perhaps communal parks, extensive landscaping that would have included orchards and gardens, as well as more formal park spaces. Then we came to the era of really mass suburbanization on the streetcars, and then mass suburbanization with mail order houses and automobiles by 1900. Now, your Edible Estates Project is looking at the era of the sitcom suburbs of the 40s and the 50s after World War II, especially a place like Lakewood, which was probably one of the two or three largest mass-produced suburbs of that time. It was an urban-scale place, but it was constructed as if individuals were simply buying half a dozen houses from the developer, and yet when a place like Lakewood, which is one of your examples, was finished, it had about 80,000 people. So the United States entered a very different period. Federal subsidies were going to middle-class and working-class households headed by white males who were going to these suburbs. It tended to be impossible for anyone who was not a white male to get a mortgage in the 40s and 50s and early 60s. There were many kinds of insurance programs that were coming from the federal government to support the developers receiving production advances from banks. And in a way, it's quite important to understand this has been going on now when we face a terrific mortgage crisis in this country, and many of us don't really know the ins and outs of all of the banking arrangements. But what became clear with those huge mass suburbs of the 40s, 50s, and 60s was that they would need some kind of serious attention and repair. They didn't have a public realm. They rarely had town centers. They rarely had parks or public spaces. They were 17 or 18,000 houses in many cases. And we got to a stage when then there were edge nodes built, and finally people working in the edge nodes driving to rural fringes, to places like this pod, which is up on the screen, which is a suburb of a kind that suggests a very placeless landscape. And so Americans need to think about how we have organized our land use and how we have used federal funds to support individual homeowners and developers without ever asking what's the common good in terms of the use of energy and in terms of the use of public space for purposes of community. So what I loved about the Edible Estates suggestion is that you can begin locally, whether you're in Kansas or in New Jersey or in Los Angeles, and you can have a conversation on the sidewalk about what suburban land use really means. You're bringing it home to people day by day in a very, very direct way. And I loved also that there were many children engaged in these conversations and engaged in the planting. It reminded me that someone like Alice Waters has worked very extensively with public schools in California to make sure that children are planting things, growing things, and cooking things, and that the meaning of a garden is something much more shared than private. So this is a little bit of the suburban context, which seems to me important to spell out so that we can understand why even in the middle of Manhattan we should be having a very serious conversation about millions of front lawns and backyards and how we might understand them for the future.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, I'm going to take a quite different tack, actually, on this project. When I first started looking at Fritz's work in the Edible Estates Project specifically, one of the things that struck me was a comment he made about the idea of spaces of agency, places wherein one can have control over what actually happens there. And within our larger context, and as Fritz was talking about, within this particular socio-political situation, that is felt to be ever more taken away from us as the general public. And perhaps the only space of personal agency thus left is our private property. And I'm not quoting you directly, but it was something, I'm paraphrasing something Fritz had said. And I was thinking about that with respect to the idea of the public gesture as well. Because the Edible Estates, even while being, again, situated within one's private property and very much about that notion of the presentation of one's own space, what becomes quite interesting about these different versions of the Edible Estates were the other responses to it and the place, the responsibility others felt over those spaces as well, and the kinds of comments and opinions that came up about it. In certain cases, very hostile responses to that transformation of the front lawn of the suburban garden into these sustainable gardens, and investigating what that response might connect to as in a larger cultural way, I think is also a very important part of the project that he's doing. This was of interest to me because of what I have been doing at the Whitney Museum on one part for the last 8 years, which was running our Altria branch, a project space in Midtown Manhattan, well, very close to here, just a couple blocks away up until a month ago when it closed. But for the past 25 years, has been committed to presenting commissioned projects of contemporary artists in a somewhat quasi-public space. There's a very large sculpture court, which you can see in this image here, one part of it's about 5,000 square feet, and it's also, it's a public space as well as a art presentation, as one wherein we present these commissioned projects for art. There's also a gallery space which follows a bit more of a standard institutional gallery feel, so is not quite as relevant to this discussion. But in any case, the sculpture court and the projects that we did there was one, has been extremely significant for me in thinking about what it means to put art in a public arena. And in this case, again, one that inhabits somewhat an in-between space. It's within a private corporation, of course, but it is a public space in a part of the city that really doesn't have much in the way of a kind of residential feel, obviously. It doesn't provide a lot of intimacy within the largely corporate architecture of Midtown Manhattan, and nor places for the folks who come and live here every day to feel personal or feel engaged or feel intimate or feel proprietary, which is actually what is going to be my ultimate point. This is what you're looking at on the screen, is an exhibition by Andrea Zittel that we brought there called Small Liberties. And interestingly, actually, as an aside, Andrea is the reason I even know Fritz, and it was her recommendation for me to look at the work. So it all kind of wraps together to me with a similar idea of what these projects are about. And these wagon stations, as she refers to them, are these modular units that are then customized by individual folks who live in her community in Joshua Tree, where she's developed a kind of ever-increasing, ever-enlarging space of kind of an R&D lab for ways of living that are somewhat outside the grid, but still not so much about rejecting the status quo, but really finding ways to question the rules and the standards by which we live, and what are the ones that work and what are the ones that don't. And the integration of this art, of art and life, in a way that I think all relate to Fritz's project as well. In any case, this sort of translation of these wagon stations, which were created in the desert of Joshua Tree, an entirely different environment, clearly as a means of creating personal space, intimate space, very much about the individual's existence there out in the desert, how they might want to be out there in that barren and somewhat hostile landscape, to translate that to the urban landscape here in a way not dissimilar in terms of its hostility to the individual, at least in this part of Midtown Manhattan, to a degree, and how one then thinks about carving out these small liberties, again, the title of the show, these spaces of personal agency within a corporate architecture of this nature. And what struck me, and I think typically one would imagine what I would be speaking about is actually the hostility of the viewer to art in general, and particularly public art, and we have a long history of issues of that nature. But I have to say, what is interesting to me about having run that space for so many years, is actually the protectiveness that people brought to, not just to that space, but also to the art that was shown therein. I mean, this is not to say there weren't individual incidents and so on and so forth, but as a general rule, it really astonished me that we would present work that had incredibly ephemeral, fragile, easily damaged elements to them in order for them to work. And the artists, for their wonderful part, always committed to having the work be the way it was, even if something were to happen to it. But the audience then, I think, to some degree committed to that same gesture, which was integrating that work within their space that they felt very personal about. This sculpture court, which doesn't look that inviting certainly here, but is perhaps one of the only spaces in this area that belongs to the public, outside of Bryant Park, but inside space. The protectiveness that they brought to these kinds of projects was pretty extraordinary, and it aligned with, in my mind, sorry about that, the way that these projects were about creating your personal space and then offering it to other people to engage and to understand. And people would, I mean, you don't see it as much in these particular examples, but there were personal objects, living objects that each of the customizers would put within there. And they didn't want to have secured to the wagon stations, because they wanted people to be able to look at them and interact with them. And they would get taken a lot, but almost always in every incident, as someone would take them, someone else who was familiar with the space and who came there regularly and felt it to belong to them would stop them and have them put it back and explain what it was. And we had it all on video all the time. It was really extraordinary. We'd watch it in the gallery, and after a while, we'd stop running out there as soon as we saw someone take something and just wait to see if somebody would come and stop them, because in a weird, in an odd way, that was almost the completion of this kind of project to a much greater degree. So there's so much more to be said about that, but I just want to lay that out as an idea of what this means, this area of agency and this idea of publicness and protecting one's community in a certain way and often in places that you might not otherwise imagine it to be.
Fritz, I'm wondering if you would describe what that image is of.
Right. This is the Edible Estate Regional Prototype Garden number 4, which was commissioned by Tate Modern last summer. And this is a green, well, it's a lawn that was previously unused, surrounded by council housing estates. So it's the garden that I created there was made to be communally tended by the residents of those housing projects, and this was their harvest party, which I couldn't be there for, but I had a photographer there who's taking pictures every week and sending them back to me, so I get these kind of remote stories of what's happening.
Well, I'm totally thrilled to be here with this amazing group of people, and Fritz's work is really coming from, of course, as he said, out of nowhere, coming back from a strange trip to Australia, but in another way, of course, a really long and deep connection, agriculture and culture, of course, being related, being about growing things, about process, and about what we're attempting to do, not just as artists in this generation, but also, of course, as people producing food, which is to get past a culture of consumerism and move into a new era where we recognize that we are all co-producers. We are all co-owners. The process of food is something we all have a hand in. As Fritz said, we live in a world where the connections of where anything is from have been deliberately erased. And so the labor history, the social history, the ecological history of most of the things that we consume and most of our actions are concealed from us. And what does it take to actually reconnect the dots? What does it take to begin to realize consequences and live in a world where you're actually aware not just of cost, and you know, it's not an accident that in our generation what we've masterminded is putting the business news first and only talking about things in terms of economics and not human cost, which is so much more costly. And dealing with human cost and dealing with ecological cost, and one of the tasks of artists at this moment is, of course, what your third grade teacher told you with long division, show your work. You know, you have to show how you got that answer. And I'm going to check your work, not just your answer. And what are the steps? What are those processes involved? And what were the engagements? And for me, one of the liberational aspects of Fritz's work is he redeems in a beautiful new way for our generation and a new century the tradition of American landscape painting, which is utopian in its impulse, which is the idea, for me, the old-fashioned way to produce art, which I just love. It's a two-step process. A, imagine the world you want to live in. B, create that world. And then go for C, live in it. And that approach that art is actually here, not just as a theoretical construct, but in fact is something that actually shapes, gives meaning and resonance to every gesture that we're making in our lives. To me, that presence is really beautiful in Fritz's work, and that he takes at the same time the avant-garde tradition, which is obnoxious intervention by artists in the life of lovely bourgeois people, and takes that for, you know, all of its appalling aggression, and it's no accident that for one century art was made in military terms, avant-garde of course being a military approach. But what then Fritz does is move it to the next phase, which is just such a relief because, in the words of one of my all-time favorite books, every war must end. You know, and it's really hard for people to imagine. Yes, thank you. It's like,
really, when it comes to ending a war, it turns out, you know, you have to do things that you refused to do 5 years and 10 years before, but you have to do them ultimately. And what is the process, not just of the provocation, but actually ending the war? Moving to a shared space where it is actually cultivated, and the process of solving the problem actually creates the community and deepens the sense of community stakes. And one of my best friends in Los Angeles, Friday night, the cops invaded his grandmother's house in the projects and arrested 5 family members, including the women in the family who were videotaping the arrest of the men, and they were arrested for interfering with police action and resisting arrest. And they were all slapped with gang injunctions. And we're spending an awful lot of money on this approach to building community. And it is catastrophic. And the question is, can we reverse the process of what we're investing in and how we're investing in it? And investing in a series of actions that by themselves, well, what I can say about the arrest on Friday night is my friend became a real community activist that night. Because when you have 5 people from your family to get out of jail, you become an activist. What does it take to get people to become activists again? What kind of intervention? What do you have to prove to people to say you have a huge stake in this? Because we actually do, and because the way we're living is truly, deeply, profoundly unsustainable and actually has to change. And the set of images that we grew up with, and you know, this is a generation awash in phony nostalgia, I'm sorry, those images themselves are toxic and non-sustainable. And what will it take to actually tear the pages out of your childhood books and start over with a new idea of what your imprint is on the earth? And in what way are we sharing the planet as humans? And what does it mean that the resources really have to be shared from here out? Thank you. So I like Fritz's art. And I think what's very important is to move beyond an era and a generation of art that specialty was just problematizing everything, and moving to the place where you problematize and you engage and you create the possibility for people to move to the next steps together through some kind of exchange, interaction, debate, and the provocation doesn't end with the initial gesture, but in fact becomes sustainable, which I think is the real question right now as art practice. In what way are we creating that is genuinely sustainable? And not just this picture will hang in this museum 150 years from now, it's sustainable that way, but in what way will communities take responsibility for keeping something alive and present and visible as something that represents an ideal? And what does it mean as artists to create in a way that we know that the change that's needed to be made in our generation, we don't have enough time to really make this change fully, but the point of art is to hold something in front of people that we're not there yet, but we're heading towards that. And just to remind people, and rather than engage in the deep cynicism of seeing how far away we are from where we want to be, is actually create something that reminds you of how close you could be to where you want to be and reminds you how powerful every gesture is in getting there. So could I just, Dolores, could I just ask you for a second, because I couldn't believe I would meet you tonight. And you've written about, you know, super toxic America and, you know, abuse, real estate abuse, you know, and if you really had to talk about the sum total of human evil, I think the real estate industry is pretty close. Just intensity of what it means to do something to land and why it was that indigenous peoples all over the world, the main thing was land and held in common, and the main thing that was and still remains inconceivable to most indigenous peoples, is the way we divide up land and, you know, and choose not to acknowledge that we're actually holding it in common, you know, and what it means to hold it in common. Would you just say a word about, you were talking earlier about these stretch malls, you know, and this, what are the possibilities now to redirecting? I mean, you've chronicled 150 years of monster development. What are the possibilities of shifting the flow of that?
Well, I don't think that I have written about 150 years of monster development. I think that Americans have been producing suburbs for maybe 180 years, and that we produced a good many different suburban patterns that were relatively small and relatively low-key through the 19th century, where there was, in some cases, a terrific amount of interest in gardening and land use, and providing a communal center in a new suburb was pretty common in the middle of the 19th century for middle-class suburbs. But what began to happen in the 1930s and 40s was that federal subsidies for greenfield development, that is, development on raw land, began to become so large and were changing the shape of real estate development nationally. And so there started to be much, much larger mass-produced suburbs. And then there started to be subsidies also for commercial buildings such as shopping malls and big box stores in what I would call edge nodes, areas at the intersections of highways, which eventually sometimes became larger than the centers of cities and had more jobs than the centers of cities. Places grew and grew and grew, and people started to have suburban jobs rather than central city jobs. And then this fueled a whole new round of people who worked in those edge nodes, jumping in the car at 5 o'clock and driving for 45 minutes to what they thought was an unspoiled place so that they could have a lifestyle maybe a little bit closer to small town America. So the fastest growing places in the country now, many of them are the rural fringe, the rural fringes, the edges of metropolitan areas, maybe 100 miles out from where the center was originally. But it's important for us to sit here in the center of Manhattan and talk about this, because with national land use patterns like this, driven by federal subsidies, I think there's a really important question to put to Fritz. How much can you change from the grassroots, yard by yard, and how much do you have to change at the federal level by making sure that people truly understand everything about real estate and mortgages and banking and the lobbying around these issues and the hidden subsidies? You know, can you really change American land use if you get people doing an organic garden in the front yard? How many more gardens does that create? How much more awareness does that create?
Well, I think it's an interesting piece of the project. I have to say, I didn't start the project with this idea of starting a movement and having everyone literally do this. But part of what draws me to it is people hate it when I say this because they think I should think everyone should do it, and it is possible. But if it isn't, there's something beautiful about the poetic impossibility of it. And saying, and then once people are confronted with that possibility, they say, wait a minute, that's too depressing. We can do it. And then there's that, both of those equally opposite feelings contained in this garden, that it represents the hope that each of us individually has the power to shape our landscape, and the kind of impossibility of it in the face of this ridiculous system that we're embedded within. And there's something about that play back and forth that I think is the story of the garden, and I don't, beyond that, the reality of it actually happening and becoming something, I don't know, I don't feel, I think there's so much I'm unqualified to do or talk about that's in part of this project. I'm not a horticulturist, I'm not a, I didn't study urban planning, I don't, you know, I come from a background in architecture, and we're professionals at knowing everything, knowing nothing about everything, but pretending we do when we're talking about it. So that's what my project rose out of. Just that kind of ignorance, I suppose, being, you know, very naive.
Maybe I can help you out here for, maybe a little bit, maybe not, because what I'm going to say might be somewhat provocative. You know, it seems to me there's only one way you make it happen, right? And that's with the right seeds, right? You can't do it if you can't make a front lawn into an edible estate if the cost is going to be diesel fuel, artificial fertilizer, and pesticide. Can't do it, because what's going to happen is that the economy of scale of big agriculture will make it will be so much better than what you're doing on the front lawn. You're going to end up just like with ethanol, you know, corn ethanol. You're going to end up costing more to the environment planting your front lawn. However, the key to it is the seed. You need new and better seeds. Seeds which aren't going to take as much fertilizer, seeds which aren't going to take as much insecticide, seeds which won't need as much diesel in order to bring forward. And you can see this most markedly in the developing nations of the world, particularly in India and in China, where what you have are fields where particularly eggplant is something I was talking to a scientist about very recently, eggplant production in India, which is that you need to spray these eggplant with insecticide about 150 times over the growing season. And what's happening is, as Dolores points out, is that you have these fields where you're growing the eggplant in these suburban, exurban areas, right? And so what you're doing by spraying repeatedly, because the seeds aren't strong enough to live without it, is that what you end up doing is polluting all of the water source around it, okay? But there's a solution. But we all have to get our heads around it. And it's not something that most reform-minded horticulturalists interested in organic food have yet been willing to get their head around. And I fault the marketers and the big agricultural producers for this. The only way, and I'm sorry, folks, is genetically modified seeds.
Oh, my God.
I told you it was going to be provocative.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Provocative.
You
just
bet.
Tedious.
It's the only way. It's the only way.
No way. Oh,
yeah,
get
way.
Over
yeah,
it.
Way.
Get yeah, over way. Your cheap self. Listen.
Tell me, Peter. Tell me, what's the solution then?
You tell me. You know, I'm sorry, but here's where the art part actually has to engage public policy. Because public policy is usually based on exactly quantity rather than quality. You know, as if food is just a quantity, not a quality, and as if quality of life and quality of food has nothing to do with anything, and it's just about creating the largest amount of something ever, which has led to the disastrous monocultures which require those drugs, I was going to say, but those poisons, those toxins. In fact, traditional agriculture in India, amazingly, for many thousands of years has been just fine until the major Monsanto, you know, came in to redo agriculture in India, which created chemical agriculture.
You're absolutely right there.
So, in fact, the basmati rice that, you know, was attempted to be patented by a Texas company, which is unbelievable, developed across, you know, thousands of years.
I have to interrupt you. Do you know, you go to your supermarket, just want to make a point. And once again, I agree, I'm a good person, I agree with this, but I want to make a point. You go to the supermarket, did you know that the carrots you buy there, organic or not, they're patented? The oranges are patented. The apples are patented. The broccoli is patented. The kiwi fruit, it's all patented, all the way down the line. This happened in 1930. That's right. In 1930, the Plant Patent Act was passed. And the reason it was passed is they wanted to give an economic incentive to breeders, the little guy, the guys who were making new varieties. That's why it happened.
And it's transmogrified, of course, into a new situation.
Monsanto wants to hold a patent. They have 12 pending pig patents. If they get their way, they'll own the intellectual property rights to every pig on the planet.
You know, and intellectual property rights is a pretty complicated question because...
We need a lawyer.
Well, no, but I mean, again, speaking from the culture part of agriculture, you know, with intellectual property rights surely enforced, there would be no Shakespeare. There would be no Johann Sebastian Bach. That's right. There would be no Handel. There would be no blues tradition. There would be nothing shared. This whole question that what we are and our culture and our whole existence is about shared space, the imagination of sharing, the possibility of sharing, the understanding that none of us is our own author, none of us actually can exist independently, and in fact it's the interpenetrating networks that are alive and need to be sustained. And we need to redo a legal system to support that. We need to, as you said, redo a subsidy system to support that. And of course in India, which is really beautiful, you know, Vandana Shiva and those farmers' movements, because as you've said, those poisons are not just poisons in the water. They're actually, as you know, there are every year in India thousands of farmers committing suicide because, in fact, agriculture as it is in the United States is impossible. And you've actually created it all over the world. Farming is the least possible occupation right now, you know, for all of these, the economics don't make sense, the chemicals don't make sense.
Well, in fact, the scarcity is driving the commodity prices up right now.
So, all I would, for who, right? So,
yeah.
My only question is, in that regard, and I just don't want to go to the GM place, if you don't mind, because, I mean, that is, we already went there, because nobody allowed us to know, and it's all happening anyway. Yeah. But, I think that's, again, one of the questions of art, and one of the most beautiful things you've been doing for these years is, and what I try and call in my practice, the protected space. What does it mean within a world with this level of abuse at all these scales? What does it mean to actually create a protected space and to cultivate within everything going on something else, another way, to create an alternative that is cultivated, that is sustained, that is supported, that is protected? And to my mind, one of the most important things you know, about art is that it's, you know, it operates differently from marketing and from business. You know, it's not about how many, you know, how many units sold tomorrow morning after we did this talk tonight. But it's about gradually shifting the consciousness of a generation that begins to say, we're a generation that thinks torture is fine, or we're a generation that doesn't. And what culture does is create the conditions in which people begin to consider something and begin to sense where we stand and where we're aiming for. And so, in fact, it doesn't mean a unit everywhere. It means that those seven gardens, you know, like there's only one Mona Lisa, there's, you know, only one of most artworks. But the existence of that artwork is already potent and reaches beyond the room it's currently displayed in. You know, and that kind of power is what we're talking about, which is this power of imagination. And we've been in a really materialist period where people are only accounting for units rather than accounting for human imagination, human conscience, the thing that in my line of work, you know, none of us were at the Rite of Spring, and yet everybody feels they know when I say the opening night of the Rite of Spring, everybody here says, oh, yes, 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 we weren't there. And yet it's part of our lives. You know, this incredible thing that art can do is you weren't there.
And that idea, I think, of the shared that you bring up in all these terms, legally, in terms of the legal system, in terms of real estate, in terms of how we create the plants that produce the food that we eat, but in terms of how we produce art and experience art, right? Because I think artists make work whose topic responds to the world that they live in, but the way they make the work responds to the world that we live in. And I think that's something that was so interesting that Shamim was talking about, what happens when artists practice outside of the conventional institutional space. And how is that work received? How is it experienced? What happens when it transgresses into space where people aren't prepared for art? And specifically in that example that you gave, which I thought was so beautiful, and I experienced the same thing in every single garden, because the first reaction when we say we're planting these gardens is, but you're taking the most fragile, precious thing and putting in the most vulnerable place. Exactly. Right. Then what? Then what do people do with that opportunity to destroy it or to nurture it. And it's really amazing to see what happens. And that's in every single garden I plant, it's the same moment where they raise that problem. And it's the exact moment you can have that conversation with them. Yes, yes, exactly. We're putting it right where it is most vulnerable. Isn't that great? We're going to test it out. We're testing out your neighborhood. We're testing out our cities and our relationships, and we're going to see what we're made of, you know? And the fact that you have the same experiences in that museum, I think, or in the at the Altria space is really telling. And I think that's what I get so excited about when I see, like, Marla out in the world or artists that step outside of those protected spaces and start to make their work vulnerable again. And I think interestingly enough, it's true with, it seems like most of the, a lot of the work in the biennial this year is dealing with a similar issue of what happens when you transgress out of that space.
And interestingly, I think this notion of it not being prescriptive, but rather almost the opposite, kind of putting out the possibilities of a direction that may go one way or may go the other, rather than in a deterministic way telling you what it might be, which is necessary and functional for a position on public policy, for example, or a position on a legal issue, or how you actually want to see the agricultural rules be put into place. One does need to have a kind of goal, direction, something prescriptive and so on. That's how that works. But to my mind, that it's the one thing that's a... And Fritz is working in a very difficult area for this, frankly, because he is kind of in a hybrid space of engaging all of those issues as well. But that art necessarily isn't prescriptive and isn't overdetermined in the sense, in fact, its quest is to do the exact opposite, which is to put those vulnerabilities on equivalent footing with one another and allow for them to go either way. And that relates to your notion of impossibility and of failure, which is also, to my mind, a very, very resonant way that artists are working, or idea that artists are working with now, which is the notion of systems and their failures and where there is beauty in those attempts and their failures, and where there is a possibility for renegotiation by virtue of understanding how those systems might fail you or might have cracks or weaknesses, and the frailties that are necessary for our existence in the world are also replicated in the systems within which we live, and that's what that illuminates to my mind to some degree, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
So. You know, I'm my line of work is actually the history of failure, like Oedipus Rex, Hamlet, they're not big success stories, you know? It's like we tend to tell, you know, Romeo and Juliet, it didn't work out. You know, we tend to actually keep telling the stories of people who tried something and it didn't work. You know, and yet you have to keep telling that story over and over again. For me, the other beautiful thing about this generation of art is I think we've all come from a place that was prescriptive, you know, and that we were told that art was this, you know, to be created with authority in an architecture in particular, and kind of the blankness of architecture that we grew up with, that bizarre, I think of it as Robert McNamara planning the bombing raids in the Vietnam War, you know, the world viewed from above. Mm. You've never been in a village before, but you have the coordinate points and you can bomb it. But you actually have no idea and have never met anyone there. You know, and we've come through city planning and through all kinds of things that are from this grid system viewed from above where you have the coordinate points and you actually don't know the ground, you know, and you haven't set foot on it, and yet you're deciding how people should live and you're telling them how they should live, and you're creating vast swaths of stuff because it's all about an end run around democracy, because democracy takes too long, and so it's just better to tell everybody what they should do. And so this whole idea of reinvesting in democracy and really creating a project that you can't complete without everybody having to discuss it and contribute, and by the end it's not the thing you thought, it's actually what everybody made it into in some kind of really engaged process, and how they maintain it, you know.
I'm having a Jane Jacobs moment. Like, oh, okay. I want to get a "What Would Jane Jacobs Do" bumper sticker or something, isn't that? Because she comes up at this moment where those thoughts start to happen, right? Yeah. And I just have to say an explanatory note. The title of the book comes from the first sentence of her book, "Death and Life of Great American Cities," which that first sentence just kills me every time. "This book is an attack on ... like current urban planning." Da, da, da. But I thought that was such a badass way to start a book that I wanted to make it my title instead of my first sentence. But I wonder if there's something about Jane Jacobs in relationship to these topics that you think of?
Well, you know, she was a great advocate of life on the sidewalk here in New York City. And I think to some extent she romanticized the 19th century city where there would have been a mix of shops and people maybe living above the store and maybe a few factories in and around the neighborhood, people of all ages on the sidewalk. What carries over into the edible estates, I noticed that in your three examples in the book, everyone was a suburban house with a sidewalk in front of it. And so you must have looked for those sidewalks if you wanted to have that interaction there. Not every suburb has sidewalks. There are many, many suburbs where that's simply missing, and you would have people driving by and maybe honking, but they wouldn't actually be strolling by and talking to the people gardening. And so those sidewalks are there in places where there was some urban planning, where there were requirements that there should be public space, a sidewalk, maybe a even in Lakewood there would be a planting strip on the far side of the sidewalk. What that suggests is that you need a minimal amount of the public realm to even be able to imagine doing your project and making it happen in terms of citizen discussion. And it suggests, too, that when one thinks about Jane Jacobs, it's not just to take her idea of, you know, mixed use and transfer it to certain kinds of new suburban developments, which some people have advocated very strongly for the last 20 years, but to also ask, you know, what are the institutions behind getting things like sidewalks and playgrounds and parks and maybe spaces where you might have farmers markets, and how do people make those work? And if for some reason in a given family there are two people working full-time jobs and they're doing childcare and they don't have time to plant their entire yard as a kind of a mini farm, what else might they do to support a broader public life? How do you imagine this beyond the edible estate? And that's a very provocative question, I think. And it suggests that there should be multiple choices. Often the suburbs of the 50s were presented to people as choice, but there was relatively little choice involved. It was cheaper for many families to buy a house in a place like a Lakewood or a Levittown than, in fact, to stay in the city or to go to certain kinds of more diverse neighborhoods that people might have enjoyed a larger public life in. And so to restore choice is pretty complicated. You have to really get deeply into the mechanisms of individual choice, household choice, in our society, and when that's happening in a very real sense, and when there's something which has been manipulated and limited. And the more we can talk about questions like that in the landscape, I think the more we would start to criticize our larger landscape, the landscape of sprawl. I wrote The Field Guide to Sprawl as a dictionary of bad building patterns because I wanted people to be able to spot things like big box stores, boom burbs, stretch malls, tank farms, and we drive past them every day living in more suburban places than the center of Manhattan. And it's often, though, a kind of mindless drive without saying, okay, the tank farm is the place where you understand what our energy consumption is. It's much, much higher than most other people on the planet for Americans. And it's also something that requires that we import 2/3 of our oil. When you drive by a big box store, it's important to say not only is this a kind of monster windowless building, but frequently these things are surrounded by vast amounts of parking because the trucks are so large and the trucks have to move. And so here are pedestrians trying to be pedestrians in space that's scaled for cars and trucks and for a certain kind of world commerce that may really not be what we would like to be supporting. And so each one of these building types in the suburban landscape can be taken apart for its larger meanings in a global sense and its larger political meanings. And the more we do that, as you might suggest we should also do it with our food, the more material life tells us, the details of material life tell us where we really are politically.
Is that a sign?
That was you.
That is the signal.
Someone
that was awesome.
That's Paul's
that
signal.
Was very exciting.
Who did that? I think there might be a discussion moment, no?
Paul, does that mean we go to questions?
Is the audience involved? Yes.
But people haven't started throwing vegetables yet.
Shall we ask people to participate?
I think that's the idea.
I've had some thrown at me.
Oh, I got it.
I think there's a microphone also for people.
There it is. It's on the floor.
You were talking about the cultural desert of suburbia, and one book that addresses a way, that suggests ways to convert suburbia into superbia, that's superb-ia, exclamation mark, is by Don Chiras, C-H-I-R-A-S, and it's a wonderful short, 160 pages and 40 pages of references. And suggestions and websites and resources on how to convert the cultural wasteland of suburbia into a rich community.
Well, I don't think anybody up here has said that suburbia is a cultural desert or a cultural wasteland. I think we've been talking about the possibilities for a greater amount of public space and interaction around the shape of the landscape and the use of the landscape, but I don't hear anyone here critiquing it as a terrible place. I don't think that's always the best way to go. In that people who live in the suburbs sometimes think that the city has all kinds of problems they would like to list. People in the city may badmouth the suburbs. It doesn't really get us anywhere. People in Europe always tell me they're critical of American style sprawl. People in the East Coast tell me they hate Los Angeles style sprawl. Everyone would like to have it somewhere else. But this larger culture involves cities and suburbs and metropolitan regions. And if we figure out how we're all going to make this work a little better as a society, it's probably a far more effective way to go than deciding that we've got a desert out there or people who are not living the right way.
May I just make one little addition to that also, which is, while we're being super correct here, and I thank you, I want to find that book, is lay off the desert. Desert is a beautiful place. And in fact, it's a lot like the assumptions of the front lawn. It's clue-free. It's not realizing, like, the deserts of South Australia have the second highest biodiversity on the planet. You know, we tested nuclear weapons there because nothing was there. It's, excuse me, the opposite.
In fact, there's a lot of good cactus, which is very good for eating, grows in the desert.
Nopales are very important to all of us. And so, anyway, praise the desert.
My question is about public space. All the spaces that we've been talking about are really private spaces. The Altria space is a privately owned public space that was created by the 1961 zoning laws in New York that gave developers leeway to build taller buildings if they created a public space. So does public space exist anymore in a public space that's free of private interests?
Well, go ahead. I would say, and you certainly have more expertise in this area, but to me it always seemed like an odd desire to make this endless distinction between the public and private when really those two things really necessarily coexist as one aspect of the other. And that, you know, private, the idea of the private public space, so to speak, or privately funded public space, while certainly it's important to question the reasons for their existence and all of the ways in which they come about logistically within urban landscape and so on and so forth, it's too simple to make those designations as one oppositional to the other, and that public spaces as well can and do follow other kinds of agendas and other kinds of intent. And what we're really trying to talk about is what are the spaces within which we can exist and communicate with one another and find some kind of sustainable connection. And if some of them have to be, if they are necessarily in combination with both of those types, both public and private, I think that's always been the case, and that we really need to think about it in a more complex way than that sort of oppositional position. But I'm sure you have much more.
Well, I'm not sure I understood the question, but I guess I would say that I understand public space to be inclusive of things like sidewalks, public schools, town halls, and I think you'd find parks. You'd find a lot of public space in Manhattan, and you would find, if you know, in different kinds of suburbs, different amounts of public space.
But it's always qualified, isn't it? I mean, we call the streets public, and yet we're not free to be there as pedestrians. It's exactly where those distinctions fall apart that I think it gets more interesting. And I don't know if we have. I don't know. I mean, in the case of edible estates, the public space is the street, and yet it's only cars that are meant to be there. Or,
it's
like you're saying,
the sidewalk,
right?
It's the sidewalk.
Yeah.
Perhaps, but it's still a public gesture what you're doing with the private space there. So that's what I mean about complicating.
Why is there this incredible expectation in this country for some completely and total and pure public space? You know, I mean, it's part of this great perfectionist idea of this country that there can be this perfect public space that we're yearning for somehow, and then these evil real estate barons have taken from us, right? I'm not so sure it's a simple bifurcation like that at all, and it's an interesting idea to get behind the expectation also.
I think many of the most interesting things happen at the places where you go from public space to semi-public to semi-private to private, and people are working across these transitions. And a traditional example might be the front porch, where people can connect with the sidewalk and the street. Eventually, the automobile made it very difficult for people to enjoy their front porches as much as they might have, say, in the late 19th century. Although teenagers, who felt very much supervised if they were courting on the front porch, were really happy to find they could drive away in an automobile and have an hour uninterrupted. And then came air conditioning, and people found, well, it was cooler inside, so the porch started to disappear. Or with traffic noise, people moved to the backyard instead of the front porch. And many of these zones are worth really tracing and understanding, because they have a great deal to do with whether you feel a sense of neighborliness and community, or whether people can't make eye contact and it's too noisy and the traffic is too heavy, and somehow then there's a sense of isolation that can set in.
And I think what goes along with this expectation for perfect public space is this incredible expectation for perfect private space, mm-hmm. right? Which is also, as we see, is highly problematic. And of course, what is the most sought after perfect private space of the American today? That's the stomach, right? And that's why we're so upset about the notion of some sort of impurity or pollution entering us when we're at our most vulnerable. We're talking about our vulnerability. That's at our most vulnerable, and then being invaded in the most intimate fashion. So it's our expectation that we can have this she agrees with me. You laugh. It's true.
Dolores, I just have a really quick question. Would you say that we're moving from more clarity between public and private as we move through time in the last few centuries, through like more subtler gradations to more strict gradations between public and private? In other words, with the disappearance of the ports, are a lot of those in between arenas disappearing? It's becoming, I mean, we're expecting more clarity today than we used to have, or something?
No, I think what we're seeing is a change in scale. And so when space was designed for pedestrians and maybe for people moving in the 19th century city, you know, usually moving either on foot or in a horse-drawn carriage or horse and wagon or something, the scale is much, much smaller than if that space is being designed for massive trucks that could be 60 feet long and are barreling down the highway. I mean, those trucks are the size of a 19th century building and they're coming at you at 70 miles an hour. You need four lanes in each direction on the freeway, and you better not get a car that's too small because you won't feel very safe out there. You know, this is what then changes everything about a human perception of space and community.
So those changes in scale are changing our ability to have those more subtle transitions that you were talking
about. I would say so, and I think that's one reason why, although Jane Jacobs was writing in the 1960s, she really idealized the late 19th century city. She lived in the West Village. That was the scale that she wanted to hang on to. And the people doing demolition for urban renewal and other kinds of housing projects were producing the space of the 1960s. And that was what seemed to her to be particularly cold. And
just to even add that, from the very beginning, the perception of space in this country, this huge perception of a large and dangerous space, right, of America, leads to this unbelievable drive towards possession of that space and taming of that space. And this ultimately is a form of imperialistic drive, of course. And it has all sorts of implications, obviously, this sense of the threatening nature of space on a huge scale, which is the primal American experience.
I just want to just add one. Oh, sorry.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I thought we have a question over there.
Thank you. It's a remark and I guess a question. The dichotomy between public and private space has, of course, existed, as far as guards are concerned, since ancient Greece and Epicureans, with the whole idea of a garden being to sequester oneself away from the city, and the garden being this closed place for philosophical discussion to take place. So I find this dichotomy very interesting, but as far as a public space is concerned in New York City, there was a professor from Cornell who created a program called Garden Mosaics. You can find it online, where communities come together in underprivileged areas of New York and take a vacant lot, and citizens of the community come together and work to plant a garden. And so I thought that went along well with what we've been talking about, taking the garden from being just a private, sequestered place apart and turning it into a community area. I guess it was just a comment.
And there are all the wonderful allotment gardens that you find in cities like London, and then they've been picked up in Boston. Many people can find a way to garden in the city, even if they don't have a lawn.
I just want to make one slight codicil also to the public space question, which is treating the airwaves as a public space as well, and the question of whose voices you hear and whose voices you don't hear. When we're trying to sustain a democracy and we need to hear from people and we only hear certain voices, or as you said, this question of choice, mm-hmm. which is you're being given in this country choice between Pepsi and Coke. And you choose, you know, it's great. But what does it mean that a whole set of other choices are not within your view? And what does it mean to actually put in a democracy a wider range of choice, make that available, make it visible, and also make certain voices that are going unheard? It takes an extra amount of work to actually create the possibility to hear them. And for me, it's one of the tasks of art in terms of the question of public space. And again, if I could just use a very private image in your own family, your sister, whoever the family member is who has refused to speak for 5 years because they feel no one's going to hear them. And what does it take to actually hear the voice of the person who's not speaking? What does it take in a democracy to not just hear the and give place to the people who are the most aggressive in terms of claiming space, but what does it mean to actually create space for the invisible, for the people who are actually operating in a completely different way? And to me, that's one of the special problems of democracy and why the intersection of art and democracy, where the chance to work space in very complicated
ways and make certain choices that would otherwise not be made commercially or would not be made, you know, from another set of points of view is a really important task at this moment. And again, why I admire your work.
It's beautiful, but look at the produce section of a supermarket, Peter, and compare it to what was there 20 years ago. 20 years ago, a typical produce section had 50 choices. Today, a typical produce section has more than 300 choices. What drives that?
The fact that most of those things are not actually foods.
No, they are. No, they
they're
are.
Food related.
No, I'm talking about fresh produce, fresh edible produce.
Fresh and edible are your words. That's all I'm saying. Like the supermarkets I'm visiting. My God. No, just stay away from the supermarket whenever possible. I think that's the solution.
I'm talking about a high-end supermarket. I'm talking about a high-end organic supermarket. I think it's interesting that the whole notion of choice is another thing that we have to be careful about simplifying. Fewer and fewer choices. I think at the same time, there are more and more choices. And I think we're overwhelmed by this unbelievable amount of choice. And there's a sense, there's this capitalistic push towards endless choice. Right, and so we can't look at it monolithically. It's very dangerous to take and just look at it from one perspective.
No, I'm totally with you. I'm just saying.
And I'm with you.
Frequently, I'm just saying special effort is required in certain cases to keep certain very delicate things and people alive in certain ways. And you just recognize that all life forms are not equally hardy. And in fact, there are different levels of hardiness, and it takes different amounts of effort to sustain different species. And to me, that's a really an issue about art, where somebody has actually chosen to spend a lot of time in this obscure corner doing this obscure thing to keep something alive. And that, to me, is really, really important part of the survival of the species value of artwork.
And it's the whole basis of agriculture. I mean, that's the origin of agriculture. Is somebody spending extra time to turn a weed into something else.
Yeah, or to get rid of those weeds, of course.
Well, we're talking about the garden and the origin. I mean, I've talked to a number of people who are theorizing about the very origins of agriculture. How did this happen that we have weeds that all of a sudden became crops? And there are many different theories, and one of them is that originally, that first fenced-in area where you would actually were going to make a special place for your plant was a holy space. It was a holy space because the idea was that certain vegetables or fruits were necessary for religious observance, and if you were going to gather them outside, there was the possibility, the danger again, of that exterior large space. They could be cursed. But if you keep them enclosed in this holy space, you can actually be sure of their spiritual purity. And this, then, is the beginnings of agriculture.
Well,
I think it's very suggestive.
The verse from the Vedas, which is way back at the beginning, is the finest of the milk and the curds becomes butter. The finest of the water that we drink becomes life. The finest of the food that we eat becomes mind. And the finest of the light that we receive becomes speech. And it's actually holding food as sacred, not as a commodity, but as something sacred that has to be handled as something sacred, that has to be shared as something sacred, that has to be recognized it is extremely rare, valuable, fragile, and needs to be honored. And then needs to, if I may say, be prepared as something sacred. It needs to be cooked beautifully. And so,
or eaten raw as something sacred.
Well, right, but all I mean to say is not just as a food service industry. You know, and I think that's one of the questions of deindustrializing, you know, in the 21st century. Really key life processes that actually need to remain personal and need to remain cooking with something more than just nutrients, but understanding that there's a whole range of nutrients that are cultural, that are emotional, that are spiritual, that are also being exchanged and shared and cultured.
Do we have a question there?
Yes. I was just wondering, How did you approach these people to redo their lawns? And did it take some coaxing for them to let go of their lawns? And how many zoning laws did you break in the process?
I'd love to break some zoning laws someday and get in trouble for that. That hasn't happened yet. The gardens are commissioned by local art institutions, museums, and once they've invited me to do it, I'll send out an announcement in that city that gets circulated, and people that fulfill the requirements that are on my website then get in touch and send pictures of their front lawn. So the people that get in touch to do it are already, eager and willing participants in the project. I'm not convincing anyone to do anything. I'm just a catalyst. I'm giving them an opportunity to do something that they might not have the guts to on their own, and it gives it some legitimacy in a way that they wouldn't have otherwise. Because if they just went out and did it themselves one morning, maybe and without any support, it's one thing. But if a museum is commissioning it and there's a book with the name on it of what they're doing, it's a little less radical and maybe it's a little bit more official or something, I suppose. But so I'm not really convincing anyone. But I would love to do it in a gated community where people get arrested and go to jail for planting vegetables. That would be my dream, I think. Are there any other questions?
Should we let people go out into the rain? Yes.
Thank you very much.